Hey, from New Jersey, it's the SNL Nerds, the show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out about Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, John Trumbull.
And I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
Hey, Darren, how you doing?
Doing good, sir, doing good. Happy Thanksgiving to you and yours, to one and all.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Happy belated Thanksgiving. You had a good holiday, I trust?
The wife and I, you know, we stayed nice and safe. I made a nice little pasta bake with, some cheese and pasta and ground sausage, the whole nine yards. Called our folks, said happy Thanksgiving, you know, keeping everybody safe, you know, and just being thankful for all we have during these end times.
Nice. Nice. That is cool. All right. Well,
how about you? You did okay?
I did okay. I muddled through. That was...
it's like the name of... that could be the name of my autobiography. Muddling through.
Muddling through. Yeah. Since it was a holiday this week, we didn't have a new episode of Saturday Night Live this week. So instead, we decided to watch a new documentary that is on Showtime right now about Mr. John Belushi, called Belushi.
Yes, this documentary called Belushi, directed by R.J. Cutler, available now on Showtime, just came out a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great doc. But before we get to the doc, John.
Oh, yes, we have some breaking SNL news.
That's from a song.
That is, yes.
Oh, John, I'm losing my mind.
Yeah, so, we all are. We all are.
So SNL recently put out who will be hosting the next three shows in December, and it was a big to do for all of us in all us SNL nerds.
We were all a flutter about it. Some interesting hosts there. We got some interesting people coming up.
Yes. So the next new show, December 5th, next week, we got Jason Bateman and musical guest Morgan Wallen. Jason Bateman, this will be his second time hosting. He first hosted 15 years ago, back in 2005. And Morgan Wallen, of course, you'll remember as the person who was supposed to be the musical guest for the Bill Burr episode. But he decided to go out and party out in these Rona streets. And SNL was like, nah, man, you can't be on the show no more.
Yeah. Now, is it Wallen or Whalen? I thought it was Whalen.
According to his Twitter account, it's pronounced Wallen.
Okay, well, that's dumb.
You going to tweet him that?
I'm not going to tweet him that, but I'm just saying it looks like it should be pronounced Whalen, so...
I believe it's Wallen.
So
to go challenge him and say your last name is dumb and you're pronouncing it wrong, then by all means have at it.
Yeah. I mean, that's fine. I mean, I'm excited that Jason Bateman is going to be hosting the show again. I'd honestly forgotten that he'd hosted once before until, like, I saw a promo the other night at the 10 p.m. rerun. They were showing clips of Jason Bateman from when he hosted in 2005. So I was like, oh, well, he's hosted before. That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I think, I don't remember him hosting either, but, like, I think maybe the show he hosted was a little... I think it was okay. It wasn't really super eventful.
Mm-hmm.
But so maybe it's, you know, not worth remembering. But, you know, I like Jason Bateman. He's, you know, great. He's good in comedy, good in drama.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see how I'm happy to see how he does in sketch. And as far as Morgan Wallen is concerned, I don't know much about him. I'm not a huge country music fan. I'm not a huge country music buff. But, you know, I'm willing to give him a listen.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice that the show's given him another shot after the whole... you know, brouhaha last time around. So
yeah, I really thought they wouldn't bring him back until like next year or something. I was a little surprised that they're bringing him back so soon.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Lauren's just trying to do right by all the people who were supposed to come on the show that weren't able to for whatever reason. So
yeah, very true. So so that's December 5th. December 12th, we get our first time host Timothée Chalamet. and musical guest Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band.
That's a weird combo, right?
It is. Yeah, no, you're right. You were saying what we're all thinking.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily put that host together with that musical guest, but...
Yeah, I mean, for those that aren't, you know, very familiar with Timothée Chalamet, he's like a hot, new, young, and up-and-coming star. He's in the upcoming Dune remake. You probably remember him from Call Me By Your Name, and I believe he was in the last remake of Little Women. Yes, he was. He was in Little Women. He was in Lady Bird. He was in Beautiful Boy with Steve Carell. So, like, he's definitely, like, he's, like, one of the new up-and-comers.
Yeah, so, Timothée Chalamet, he's, like, one of those guys that I know his name, but I haven't seen him in anything still. So, I might be able to pick him out of a lineup, but that's about it.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Like, I saw Lady Bird. I don't remember much about it. But, yeah, I haven't seen Little Women. I didn't see Call Me By Your Name. I didn't see Beautiful Boy. I might see the Dune. I'm not a huge Dune guy, so I might see it. I might not. I don't know. So, but I know a ton of people like him. A lot of people, you know, he's a handsome young man.
And he's popular. He's the it boy.
Yes.
Do they have it boys? Do they have it girls?
Yeah, he's one of the new it boys. He's
okay,
got it.
He's
a star. And we got Bruce Springsteen, the course of, you know, Jersey's own, the king of New Jersey, our Lord and Savior.
Yes.
Appealing
to the middle-aged SNL podcaster's demographic with the musical guests this season. So
Yeah, absolutely. So this speaks to me. Yeah, with this lineup, I'm a little bit more looking forward to seeing what the musical guests will do rather than the guest host. But, you know, I mean, who knows? Should Timothée or however you pronounce his name, like he might surprise me. Is it Timothée? Because it's spelled like with two E's. And there's like an accent mark over the first E.
Oh, there's an accent mark? Okay, well, then all bets are off. I don't know.
Yeah, the way he spelled his name is just like what are you trying to do here, man?
But what, does his name rhyme then?
I don't know.
Timothée Chalamet?
I don't know. It's like that actor, Jack A.
Yeah.
In the 80s. Is that how you pronounce it? Jackie?
He is Jack A, the lady from 227, yes.
Yeah, so it's the same thing where it's not Timothy, it's Timothée.
And you know, like I think that musician from the 80s, Sade, she had the accent mark over the E, so.
Oh, yeah, it's not Sade?
It's not Sade, no. I asked, and apparently it is not Sade.
you asked her directly? Like,
just people on the street.
Oh. you just walked up to a random stranger? Hey, excuse me, sir, how do you pronounce Sade?
Yeah.
Is it Sade or Sade?
Yeah. And they told me to go away.
Yeah, I could. I saw that coming.
Yeah. It was all right, so that's on their part.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, you made a good choice, sir. I should leave.
Yeah, no, I agree. I totally see where you're coming from.
Okay. All right, so that's December 12th. And December 19th, final show of 2020, we get Kristen Wiig and Dua Lipa. Kristen Wiig, this will be her fourth time hosting, if you count the SNL at home. And Dua Lipa, she was supposed to be on the show back in March with John Krasinski, but of course that show never happened because the world died.
Yes. I remember hearing something about that, yes.
Yeah, of course. The Earth is dead and we're all just living on its bloated corpse.
Yeah.
So what do you think about Kristen Wiig?
I'm familiar with her. I have seen some of her work. I'm surprised. It's like... fourth time hosting. But yeah, the SNL at home, I don't know if that really counts because that's really just, she just did like an introductory segment, right? She didn't really do any sketches or anything.
Yeah, she just did like, oh, hey, I'm Kristen, I'm hosting. And she did like a quick little like thing of comedy there. But
yeah.
She wasn't in any of the other sketches. She's just like, you know, just bookended it within the beginning and the end.
Yeah. Okay. I'd give her a half star there.
Okay.
Personally. What do you think?
I don't. I mean, I guess it depends on whether you consider SNL at home an official SNL episode or not. I mean, yeah, some people see that as like an asterisk in the book of SNL. I don't know. I see both sides of the story.
I consider them real episodes, but it's tough for me to consider somebody who just, you know, opens up the show at the beginning as a real host when they're not doing the other things that the host does, you know?
I mean, if you want to get into it, if you really want to get into it, George Carlin hosted the first SNL episode, and he wasn't in any of the sketches.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, no. I mean, and that's a valid argument, but that, you know, that was before they figured out the format of the show, really. So
yeah, it's fair enough.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not gonna fight with your heart on it. And if you're like, you know, Christian Bick officially hosted four times, I'll be like, okay.
Come on, John, fight me. Why won't you fight me, Trumbull?
I you know, the world's dead. I mean, is it really worth it? No, I don't know.
Yeah, you're right. All right, so so that's the December 19th show, final show of 2020. And I've seen a few people saying that because Kristen Wiig is hosting, they feel like, well, then that's kind of a signal that that'll definitely be Kate McKinnon's final show. Because, like, maybe it's a way to usher her out with, you know, bringing in Kristen Wiig. I mean, I don't know if I'm totally sold on that.
I don't know why that necessarily follows. Like, Kristen Wiig hosts, therefore it must be Kate McKinnon's last show. I don't quite get that.
I don't know. Some people see it as, like, a passing of the torch or something like that. Because it'll be a big show because it's the final show of the year. It'll be the Christmas show. And, like, people say, oh, that'll be the show that Kate bows out. I don't know. I don't really see the logic behind that. But, yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me.
It wouldn't shock me if it turned out to be Kate McKinnon's last show. I mean, because there has been talk about her leaving the show this season, and, you know, now that the election's over and all that. I just don't get the logic of Kristen Wiig is hosting, therefore is Kate McKinnon's last show.
I don't know. People online are weird.
Yes, they are. They are. They make such weird assumptions sometimes.
Yeah. Except not our fans. Our fans and listeners, you guys are really cool.
Yeah, yeah. Like 97%. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The 3%, you know who you are.
Yeah. Yeah. You 3%, you really freaking weirded us out. And don't do that ever again.
Lose our number.
Yeah.
So those are the final three shows for 2020. You know, looking forward to them, and hopefully we'll see what happens with these.
I think of the three, I'm probably most looking forward to seeing Jason Bateman host, just because I'm familiar with him and his work, and I'm a fan of him and his work, and it'll be neat to see him on the show again. I'm assuming I watched him last time because I was a big Arrested Development fan back in the day, and I can't imagine that it was something I missed. Kristen Wiig, I'm of two minds about it. You know, she's very talented. But I quite honestly got kind of sick of her before she left the cast. So,
I see what you're saying. Like, she's one of those performers who, like, on the. She's diversifying a little bit more now that she's, like, you know, acting in movies and stuff, showing a little bit more range. But I think when she was on the show, she was one of those performers that was just, like, really good at the quirky type of persona, and she never really kind of, you know, veered away. She had, like, one thing she could do really well, and she did that really well. She wasn't like Bill Hader, who was, like, more diverse and, like, more versatile and can do other things.
I mean,
and I think a lot of people got sick of that.
Yeah, I mean, she's a great performer, and she did a lot of great things on the show. And I totally get why she has the fan base that she does. I just got sick of her just because she came to dominate the show so much. It felt like her last few years on the show, like, every sketch was built around her. And I don't want to ever see the show built around any one person, you know?
Right. I mean, people say that about Kate McKinnon now. They've said that about past, cast members, you know, back in the past. But yeah, I did notice that, like, she was in a lot of sketches during her tenure there, especially as she got more and more popular. They seemed to, like, just, like, overrun. Did she just be, like, she was just everywhere as far as sketches go. It got to be a bit much.
It got to be a bit much. I remember at one point, somewhere late in her tenure, I referred to SNL as the Kristen Wiig talks out of the side of her mouth show. And that's kind of what it felt like at the time.
Yeah, very much so. Like, I mean, so much so that they gave her that big send-off with the you know, the with the Mick Jagger singing "She's Like a Rainbow" to her as people,
cast
members dance with her.
That's very rare. They would not usually make such a big deal out of it being any particular person's last show. And it's also weird because it also turned out to be, like, I believe Jason Sudeikis and Andy Samberg's last show, if I remember correctly. It was all about Kristen Wiig. I mean, maybe they didn't know for sure that would be their last show at that point. But and if you go back and look at that that clip, Jason Sudeikis looks pissed.
I looked at that. I thought he was like about to cry because he was sad that she's leaving.
It could be either way. I mean, it's tough to know, but he does not seem. Yeah, he's either very overcome with emotion or he's pissed, or it's very tough to read his expression in that.
Yeah, because I do remember seeing him when he danced with Chris, and I do remember that look on his face, like he was going through something.
Yeah,
I was like, oh my God, is he all right?
But, I mean, they obviously wouldn't have done something like that on the show if she wasn't very, very well loved there, so.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I can think of
that was the time that Kate McKinnon was, like, literally just starting.
Right, exactly. I mean, I could see, I don't know if Kate's leaving at the end of this year, but if she does, I can see them doing something like that for her.
Yes. Yes, I agree. They probably will do something special to mark her send-off.
Right, like some, you know, they have like Dua Lipa or somebody sing some big flourishy, flowery song for her.
Boy, that would be a big come down after Mick Jagger, though.
Yeah, Mick's busy, so we got Dua Lipa.
Yeah.
Singing that one song she has.
Yeah.
I don't know, that's good, right?
Anyway, we'll see what happens. But it'll be neat to see them close out the year like that. I guess Lawrence had everybody back that he was supposed to have on, except for, say, John Krasinski, right?
Yeah, he's still, I guess he has to, they have to figure out, you know, they have to give him like a do-over. Mm-hmm. It looks like it'll probably won't be until next year.
Guess not. Yeah. And who knows where we'll be then.
Yeah, dudes. I mean, we could all die tomorrow.
Yep.
Jeez, I'm sorry. That got dark. I apologize. I apologize, listener.
I mean,
that
was dark, but not necessarily inaccurate.
Yeah. That's true. We could all die tomorrow.
And speaking of dying.
Oh, Christ almighty.
I'm sorry. The transition was right there. As we said at the top of the show, we're watching Belushi, the new documentary about John Belushi, written and directed by R.J. Cutler. And it's a really interesting piece of work, right?
Yeah, it's definitely different than other documentaries I've seen. I mean, one of the main differences is that they tell you right up top, like usually in a documentary, they'll have like interviews and talking heads with people who were close to the subject matter. But in this one, there's none of that. It's all audio used from interviews conducted by Tanner Colby, mm-hmm. who is creating a oral history of Belushi's life. So it's all audio. And then they show like pictures and, you know, home movies and video footage throughout the doc.
Right. And I was kind of surprised when I saw that at the top of the film, because like I own this book, Belushi. It came out somewhere in the early 2000s. I got it like a few years. I think it came out in 2005, it looks like. And I got it like a few years later when the Borders books chain was closing. And I picked it up for a big discount because they were, you know, doing the clear out sales. And it's a great book. Highly recommended if you ever come across a copy of the book. It's really good. So I'd heard a lot of these stories before, but this is the first time the audio of those interviews had actually been publicly released.
Right. And it's pretty thorough. You hear from a lot. I mean, we'll go into it, but you hear from a lot of people, you know, close to Belushi, mm-hmm. like friends. Of course, Judy's in there.
Yeah.
Lorne, Aykroyd. And I did kind of get a little wistful or something when I heard audio from people who are no longer with us, like Harold Ramis and Penny Marshall, Tom Danny Davis, Fletcher. Carrie Fisher. Yeah, I was like, oh,
yeah.
So you do get that a lot throughout this doc.
But yeah, that was what I thought was really interesting, was that there, because these interviews were conducted quite some time ago, like probably in the 90s, early 2000s. Yeah, a lot of the people who were interviewed about John Belushi are themselves no longer with us, like Harold Ramis, Carrie Fisher, Penny Marshall, and a few others I'm sure I'm forgetting. But
Tom Davis.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, Tom Davis. Yeah, we hear from him briefly. Like Tony Hendra, they have recollections from him in there, but I guess they didn't have audio from his interview for whatever reason, so they had somebody reading Tony Hendra in the movie.
Oh, wow.
Did you see that in the closing credits?
I did. Oh, yeah, I did. I thought that was him. I didn't know it was somebody else reading.
No. It credited. Let me see if it says on IMDb.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, another thing that I also really liked about this doc is, like, for some of the reenactments during the documentary, they were animated. And you can see, yeah, there's some really good animation in this documentary. It was done by Robert Valley, who's from Aeon Flux fame and did some stuff with the Gorillaz. But, like, I really dug the animation they use, the animation style in this documentary.
Yeah, the animation is spectacular. Okay, I just found it on IMDb. Tony Hendra, it was, lost it in the cast list. It was.
Okay.
I can't find it again, so never mind. I'll credit him when I can.
All right. Well, we'll get to it later. See what else. I mean, well, also another thing that I noticed throughout the documentary is they have like handwritten letters that Belushi wrote to Judy, his his longtime girlfriend and wife. We also learned
they were high school sweethearts.
Yes, they met back when they were in high school back in 1966 in Wheaton, Illinois, which is a suburb outside of Chicago, and they've known each other since high school. I think she says that their first date was like a homecoming. I think he was a homecoming king or queen.
Belushi was the homecoming king. And she said that was kind of like an omen for their relationship, because as the homecoming king, he had to dance with the homecoming queen. And so she ended up dancing with the homecoming queen's boyfriend for much of the night. So once again, like, John was kind of the center of attention, and she was sort of left behind a little bit. I found it for the voice of Tony Hendra in some aspects was by John Purdy.
Oh, okay. Very good. Well, and also another voiceover that they do, like I was saying, they have some parts where Belushi is writing letters to Judy, you know, as their relationship blooms and blossoms. And we see like the letters, and then they're being read by like a voiceover, and the voiceover is done by Bill Hader.
Yeah, that was something I didn't know going in, and like when I'm listening to it, I didn't place Bill Hader's voice at first. I was like, this voice is really familiar. I know this voice from somewhere. what is it? And it was like on the tip of my tongue for all the documentary, and then finally at the end it says, you know, voice of John Belushi, Bill Hader, and I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's like, oh, it's a nice little, another little SNL tie-in. It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, the documentary starts, we learn about Belushi's kind of his youth, learn that both his parents are from Albania, which, of course, back then, no one knew where Albania was. You know, I actually didn't know where it was either until, like, I looked it up. It's like, oh, it's near Greece. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, we learn about his dad, how his father was like a very serious man. He didn't really laugh and smile. He worked he ran a diner, which of course was the impetus to the cheeseburger sketch, you know, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
I mean, him and his mom seemed to have a good relationship. It seemed like he wasn't super close with his parents, but you know, he did love them.
He seemed like he was closest with his grandmother, his Nana.
Yes.
Who was, like, they were immigrants, and his Nana didn't really speak English, but they talked about how Belushi was, like, always entertaining the family at family meals. And this is where you see a lot of the animation for Belushi's childhood and stuff, because, of course, they don't have footage for this and only, like, a few photos and things like that. And the animation is really impressive by Robert Valley.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but yeah, then we also learned that, you know, he was into performing at a young age. Like in high school, they said he was into football and he was into theater. Mm-hmm. He was one of those guys. And he also really loved listening to, you know, comedians on vinyl, like Jonathan Winters and Bob Newhart. Yeah. And he also loved to play in bands in garage. Like he was always like playing the drums and stuff. So he, like from a young age, he had like a predilection to the arts. As it
were. Yeah. And he was a performer. I mean, he would go along with those records into the mirror and do the characters, and he'd write his own sketches and things like that. So he had the performing bug from a young age, and he really just seemed fated to become a performer of some kind.
Yeah. And so then they go on to say about how, you know, as he got older, he auditioned for Summer Stock in Indiana, where he was like the youngest performer to get it. And you know, I think he got his mind open to the world of arts as well as, you know, drugs and whatnot.
That was a moment I found really striking, whereas he's in one of these letters home to Judy. He talked about, he's like, I tried pot for the first time. You know, it's interesting. It's like, you know, much more intense than alcohol. I might try it again, I guess. and you see that and you're just like, oh, geez, man, if only you knew.
Oh, John. Oh, John.
You just can't help but have this bitter sort of laugh, because drugs define so much of the later years of John Belushi's life, unfortunately.
Oh, we'll get there.
I mean, but, you know, I mean, there's a lot of talk, of course, about addiction and the nature of addiction. And you know, you have people like, you have people who witnessed it, like Aykroyd and Lorne Michaels, and you have people who understand addiction, like Carrie Fisher, because she had a lot of those issues in her own life.
Yeah, like, I really, yeah, they had, like, Carrie Fisher say this one quote, which I really liked, where she said, yeah, like, drugs aren't the problem, it's the sobriety that's the problem, because, like, you know, you take drugs to sort of, you know, get out of your own head and get a kind of run away from your problem. But when you get sober, like there's no one there around. If you don't have the support system, and there's no one there around you to tell you how to cope with the issues that you're suppressing from drugs, once those issues come back up, how to deal with that.
Right.
And like that, and that's when the real shit starts to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Cause like, you know, I think she also says you don't really take drugs for no reason, or you're not a person who, if you're a person who takes a lot of drugs on a regular basis, you don't do that for no reason. And yeah, I mean, it was just very insightful. And you don't really take drugs to feel good. You take them to not feel bad. And there's something inside of you. And Belushi was like one of those people who just didn't have that switch. Like, you know, because that's what makes an addict. Like once you start, you cannot stop. You don't have that ability to just stop yourself and be like, oh, maybe I shouldn't do any more of this, because you're always chasing that high, you know?
Yeah. And like, I mean, when she said that, I was thinking, well, did he ever get him into rehab, or did he ever want like seek help, like a psychiatrist or something like that? And it seemed like he never did. Like, I mean, Judy mentioned it later about how they talked about rehab, but he didn't like that idea. And then people were saying like, well, maybe, like when he passes out or he goes to sleep, you can like just register him for a rehab and just put him in there. But like, I think Judy said, I never had the heart to do it.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of those things that really makes you wonder like, well, what would have happened if she had decided to do that? If, you know, she did have it in her to do that. And, you know, that's a rough thing to do to somebody, but I'm sure she wouldn't have even considered it unless it was necessary. But, yeah, but, you know, it was also like a different world because, you know, in the 70s, like none of that stuff seemed as harmful as it seems to us today, looking at it in 2020.
Yeah. I mean, like they were saying throughout the whole documentary, weed, it was just whatever people did. Cocaine. Yeah, that's what people did. Like I noticed that they weren't really, really concerned until they heard like heroin was introduced. Like, I mean, heard.
Yes.
Because that's the drug that casual drug doers just do not touch. Like, once you do heroin, that's like, oh shit, something's wrong.
Yeah, yeah, you've turned a corner once you start on the heroin.
Once you're train spotting, then it's like, oh no.
Yeah, yeah.
We've gone too
you're
far.
You're breaking out the needles, and you're sterilizing needles and all that.
Yeah, that's when it's like, you got to put together a kit that's like, oh, this is a lot of work to get this high.
It's a big commitment. It's a big commitment.
A big commitment. All right, but yeah, we'll get to. All right, back to our show. All right, so Belushi, he was doing, you know, Summerstock, and he was really getting into the theater. But then they say, well, it wasn't until he went to see Second City with Judy, mm-hmm. that's when that really cemented his love for acting. He's like, oh, this is what I want to do. And then they talk about how his father wanted him to run the business, the diner, but Belushi had to have that talk with him saying, I don't want to do that. Because I think Belushi's main philosophy was, don't do anything that you really don't want to do, that you don't put your whole heart and soul into it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, life is too short for that shit.
That is pretty amazing philosophy. And it's cool that he had such insight and such conviction at such an early age. Because like so many people, they spend half their lives figuring out what they want to do or trying to discover what they want to do. And some people never find it. And Belushi was lucky enough to know and figure it out. And it was something he was good at and something he was passionate about. And he also says to Judy after that Second City show, he's like, this is what I want to do with my life. So you are probably going to have to be the breadwinner because I'm not likely to ever earn a lot of money doing this, but it is something that will make me happy. So,
and I'm surprised, like, I don't know, like something tells me like any, I don't know, like, I mean, props to Judy. Cause like, I feel like a lot of women, once they hear something like that from their mate, a lot of women be like, no, I'm out. But like, she was like standing by her man. And that's like, it's pretty commendable.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's really a testament to how much those two loved each other. Cause you know, you sacrifice for your partner, you do what you can do to help them achieve their dreams. And she recognized that in John. And I like that John had enough self-awareness to say that to her, you know?
Yeah. Like he didn't sugarcoat it saying, hey, you know, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to make it, and I'm going to make millions of dollars, and we're going to be set.
Yeah.
He was very realistic about it.
And yeah. I appreciate that. Like it. And he realized that. And his career like just kind of builds. And he ultimately joins the Lemmings, which was a group that kind of came out of the Groundlings, right?
Yeah, well, I think he got through that because he started an improv group in college called the West Compass Players.
Oh, yeah, yes, yeah. I'm skipping ahead a little bit, yeah.
That's okay. And they were, like, very serious. Like, he was more of a political satirist where he would talk about, like, you know, what's going on in the world, but he would just kind of put it through his lens. And he was very... I think like at an early age, people started to take notice of him because he just had this energy, this like almost kind of anarchistic vibe about him.
And I mean, and this is, it's not quite the image that you have of Belushi. They have some footage of these performances and he's got, you know, really long hair as you did in the early 70s and a beard most of the time. And he like comes to the attention of Second City through this group. And Second City like asks him to audition and he's like the first person who joins the Made stage show at Second City, without being part of the touring company first. So that was a first.
Yeah, that was a big deal. I think that's where he met some other, notable, actors such as Joe Flaherty. He met through there. Harold Ramis talks about meeting him there and seeing him perform. Like
right.
he worked with
Christopher Guest, we don't hear from Christopher Guest in the documentary, but Chevy Chase.
Yeah, absolutely. And like Ramis went on to say something like they felt like they were in the presence of a genius, the way he sort of commanded the stage and how much the audience loved him. And he quickly became like the strong man for all their sketches. Like,
I mean,
as soon as he stepped on.
Yeah, they were saying like he could get a laugh just from walking on stage. And then they show a sketch where you see him walk on stage and he gets a laugh just within seconds of walking on stage, just walking to a chair.
Yeah. I mean, that's like, I walk to chairs all the time. No one says shit about me that.
Yeah. You know, I've seen you walk and sit in a chair. It's not that impressive.
I'm working on it. I'm workshopping it.
Okay. No, I'm sorry. Tough love.
Okay. All right. No, it's fine. I'll work. I'll work. I got to work on my walking, sitting skills. That's fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah. So, I mean, after that, he went on to be in the Lemmings from National Lampoon.
Yeah. And this was like a live show, and this became kind of the trendy show of the day. We see like some things that he later took to Saturday Night Live, like his famous Joe Cocker impression. It was really like the first time that we're seeing like the counterculture represented in the comedy, the live comedy of the day.
Right. I think that's the thing they were doing. They were making fun of the, like you said, the current counterculture, which is interesting because like, I mean, like when they grew up, it was like things like Woodstock and all that. Like there was Woodstock and, you know, Free Love. That was supposed to be like kind of a pushback to the culture at the time. It was people being all like kind of buttoned up and crew cuts. But now they're making fun of the thing that was pushing against the culture at the time. So it's like, I don't know. I thought it was a really interesting dynamic there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and that the Lemmings leads to the National Lampoon radio show where he meets people who were writers for the National Lampoon, like Michael O'Donohue, who we've talked about on the show before. And he meets people like Gilda Radner, who, of course, later becomes a part of the SNL cast herself.
Right, right. I think they said like Judy was doing art for the Lampoon. And then, like, O'Donohue was doing the National Lampoon radio. And then I think Judy said, oh, we should get John on the radio to do, you know, to be on the radio hour.
Yeah.
And then after that, I think O'Donohue left the Lampoon. And then they say Belushi kind of filled in and directed the radio hour after that.
Yeah. I mean, because Belushi seemed to be like, he seemed to have that personal magnetism. People would just be drawn to him, and he would just sort of automatically become the ringleader of whatever project he was a part of. And that seemed to be something that was very true in each stage of his career. Like, you know, just from high school on, even, you know, he does high school and he does the Lemmings and he does the Lampoon, and even eventually after he got to SNL, he became a ringleader there.
Right. Like he's just known to be the guy, just the leader. Everybody get in line, follow me. I'll take us into war type of dude.
Yeah.
And he was just used to that. And of course, as all this is happening, you know, more and more drugs are being introduced, but no one thinks anything of it because, you know, coke is just everywhere, man. Weed is just everywhere. It's like a fine cup of coffee.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when he gets to SNL, they're talking about it. They're just like, yeah, I mean, you would just smell it in the offices when you got there. And like people were doing coke in the offices. They were saying like Belushi did coke on Lorne's desk after Lorne had left for the day.
Yeah. And that's another thing I didn't really know about, like how Belushi and Lorne kind of butted heads and really, I mean, didn't quite get along. I think they interviewed Lorne too, and Lorne said, "Oh yeah, I saw John in his show with Gilda, and I thought he was interesting, but you know, I wasn't knocked out."
Yeah, yeah. And when Belushi comes to interview for SNL, he was just kind of like, "Well, you sell me on this show," because Belushi wasn't a big fan of television, so he was like, "Well, what you convince me that this is a worthwhile project, that this is a project worth doing." That's an interesting approach to a job interview. It's a choice.
It's a choice. Yeah. Whenever I go into a job interview, I just put my feet up on the desk and I just say to the interviewer, "Convince me."
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I'm asked to leave the Foot Locker.
And Lorne, understandably, he was like, "Well, yeah, no, I'm not really into that. I'm not nuts about this guy." I mean, he's being vouched for by people like Chevy Chase and Michael O'Donohue and all that. But Lorne was like, "I wanted people who were like enthusiastic to be a part of the project," which is not an unreasonable expectation if you're putting together a new TV show.
Yeah, you want people who care.
Who want to be there and, you know, want to do a good job and all that. But eventually, Belushi is hired on the show, And he, of course, is in that very famous first sketch with Michael O'Donoghue. I want to feed your fingertips to the Wolverines.
Right, yeah. And, of course, I think they also interviewed there was one point they interviewed Aykroyd and Belushi, who became, like, fast friends. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they met in Toronto, and Aykroyd said, oh, yeah, like, it was love at first sight. Like, as soon as I met him, I was like, oh, you're my best friend for life. This is it. And yeah. Sure enough, they were. And yeah. Then even Belushi even admits that, yeah, I was kind of a punk when I was, like, you know, kind of flexing and
stuff. Yeah, and that seems to be another recurrent thing in Belushi's life, where he's constantly pushing the limits and he's seeing how far he can go. And if he gets enough push back, then he'll pull back and, you know, be more of a good soldier. But if he doesn't get that, then he's just going to run amok.
Yeah, that's the one thing I thought that was interesting throughout this whole documentary, like how he has these two sides to him. Because, like, on one side, I mean, I think Tom Schiller said mm-hmm. it in the beginning of this doc, where he says he could be really kind and generous and sweet, mm-hmm. and but he had that flip side of the coin where he could be, like, chaotic and tortured and just, like, you know, very aggro alpha male. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know. It's just really weird. He could be both those things in one person. Like, he'd just be, like, really combative, at the same time be, like, the sweetest guy you knew.
I was
like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. He definitely had a juxtaposition to him. And when he gets to Saturday Night Live, he discovers to his shock and I'm sure to his chagrin that Chevy Chase becomes the breakout star of the show in the first year, which I think is understandable, because Chevy Chase, you know, he was, as Chevy Chase himself has pointed out, he was the one guy who would, like, look into the camera and be like, I'm Chevy Chase and you're not. So he's constantly, like, IDing himself to the audience. So that, I think, right. was a big point in his favor. And also, he was a more conventionally handsome leading man type.
Right, he was like, I guess he was, like, early branding himself, like saying, oh, I'm Chevy Chase. Hey, I'm Chevy Chase. Hey, mm-hmm. everybody, I'm Chevy Chase. And, like, they also talked about in the doc how, you know, John didn't like that because, as we said before, he was always the leader, no matter where he was. He was always the ringleader. And, like, now this other dude is getting all the shine. And then they talked to, like, they had some, they had an audio interview with Penny Marshall where Penny was like, yeah, John would talk to me saying, how come he's getting all the roles? What's this about? What's that about? Mm-hmm. But then, like, they talked to Chase, and Chevy Chase was like, yeah, well, I mean, Belushi didn't make himself part of the group, really. Like, he didn't, like, wasn't in the writing of the sketches that much. Like, I was always, like, pitching ideas. I was in the writer's room. I think, wasn't Chase, like, originally supposed to be a writer?
Yeah, I was about to say, he was originally hired as a writer, and then he became a performer as well.
Right. And even Lauren says, yeah, John had always been the ringleader, and it drove him crazy that Chase was getting all the accolades. I think at one point they also mentioned how Belushi and Lauren were kind of butting heads. And and they actually had this one point where Ann Beats, writer, was saying how she heard an interview, an argument between Lauren and Belushi, and they got into this super big fight, and then Lauren fired John Belushi on the phone.
Yeah.
And then the interviewer talked to Lorne about it, and he's like, oh, yeah, like, Ann Beats says that you fired Belushi over the phone. And then Lorne says, oh, it makes perfect sense that I would do that.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, Lorne didn't specifically recall that instance, but, yeah, Ann Beats just talks about how she finds Belushi in a bar, and she's just like, go back and apologize and get your job back, and... And of course they did, and it worked out all right. But
right, but I guess the first year, Belushi just really wasn't happy there because, as we said, Chevy Chase was getting all the accolades. Of course, there's the bee costume, which Belushi never liked. He constantly hated the bee costume, and it was just it seemed like he was having a hard time adjusting.
Yeah, I think he found the bee thing very demeaning, because, you know, it made him look very silly. But I mean, he did it brilliantly. I mean, he knew how to move his head just enough to get the maximum waggle on those antenna things that they wore. And it's just funny. It's just funny to see Belushi in that. But yeah, he really hated being, like, people on the street would be like, hey, it's the bee guy. And
yeah, it really bugged him. But then after the first year, as we all know, Chevy Chase left the show to be a big old star in L.A., and that meant Belushi was able to take a step forward, and he was now the alpha male dude in the spotlight. And that's when he started to take off.
You know, it's so weird to just to think that how Chevy Chase became the big breakout guy in the first year, and then he leaves after the first year of Saturday Night Live. It was kind of like, I think a similar thing to like Farrah Fawcett on Charlie's Angels or David Caruso on NYPD Blue. Like they, like all the press goes to their head and then they're like, oh, hey, I'm such a big deal. I can leave and go do things on my own. And it never really quite works out the way they expect it to, you know?
Never quite works out. I don't know what happened. And maybe it's his film choices or what. But yeah, like I do remember hearing that like people were like really like, amped up about Chevy Chase. They're like, oh, he's going to be the next big thing. And I mean, it kind of...
They were talking about him as like the next Johnny Carson for a while there. And yeah.
Like they were really pumped about him. And it never... I mean, it took off with movies like, you know, Vacation and Fletch and stuff, but never really like hit the heights that people thought it would.
No. And it's just, I don't know. Maybe people don't respond as strongly. Like they think like you're getting too big for your britches or something when you have such a big success so quickly and then you leave very quickly. I think that doesn't sit right with people, you know?
That might be it. They think he's, oh, you're Hollywood now, la-di-da.
Yeah.
But anyway, Chevy Chase left, and that's a good thing for us because now we got Belushi in the spotlight and we get a young Mr. Bill Murray taking Chevy's place.
Yeah, I'd say win-win.
Indeed. Two thumbs up. Wait. Yep. Uh-huh. And I mean, we also have like Alan Zweibel talking about it. How I think Lorne compared Belushi to Jackie Gleason, a little bit, just because he see them as like the everyman.
Yeah, or, I could never really I never saw that on my own before. But as soon as they made that comparison, I was like, oh yes, I totally see that. And then they show some clips where he's doing like some Gleason-esque reactions, and you're like, yeah, I can totally see that. And it's, you know, not that he's like totally copying Gleason, but he's just kind of doing a similar thing in his own style.
Yeah, very much so. Like I think they also mentioned, I remember one part where they sort of talked about where he was doing an interview with somebody and they mentioned Lou Costello, because mm-hmm. I think at the time, like, people love Lou, you know, Abbott and Costello.
Yeah.
And the interviewer was asking Belushi, oh, you know about Lou Costello? Do you like him? And then Belushi was like, no, I don't like him. I don't think he's funny.
Yeah.
And the interviewer was kind of taken aback. This is all done in like a reenactment with the animation.
Yeah. They go back to, I think that's like one interview. They go back to this interview periodically throughout the film. And it seems like, yeah, Belushi's like in a bit of a mood. It's kind of a hostile interview, man.
Yeah, it's weird.
They cut back to that interview later in the film, and the interviewer's trying to ask Belushi about his personal life, and he's like, well, what did your father do? And Belushi's like, yeah, he was a hitman. And then he just says, like, I don't want to talk anything about my personal life. You can talk about projects and stuff I've done all you want, but I don't want to talk about my personal life at all.
Yeah, and it seemed a little, like you said, hostile. Like, ooh.
Yeah.
But Belushi, he says he wants to, he kind of formed his comedic style. He said he didn't want to take anything from comedians of the past. He wanted to do something totally new and sort of reinvent, you know, comedy in a way. And in a way he did that. I mean, you do see flashes of Jackie Gleason and what he does, but it's not a total ripoff or a total copy of Gleason. It's like,
oh yeah, not at all. I mean, he's kind of, if anything, he's like interpreting it for a new age, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, he was fantastic at it. I think people compared him, they're saying like he was like a disciplined anarchist, because like he said he never wants to be like a professional. He was always wants to, like, put, like you said, push boundaries and really kind of dissect what comedy is or what it could be.
Mm-hmm.
As he got more and more into the spotlight, SNL becomes a bigger and bigger thing. You know, all the cast members become super famous. John and Aykroyd become famous. They, you know, then Blues Bar comes into play, which something I never knew about. Like, I didn't know that did they own that bar, or is it just like a bar?
Yeah. It became like a very difficult thing for them to go out in public. They couldn't just go to a neighborhood bar or something after the show. And you needed, like SNL was such a big adrenaline rush, they needed a place to kind of come down from the show after. So they bought this dive bar in New York that became like the first blues bar. And it was apparently this like cramped little club. And one person says like, oh yeah, that was the worst, foulest bathroom I've ever seen in my life. And yeah, and you see this thing that, you know, it looks like, you know, what the CBGB's bathroom was supposed to be or something. And, you know, but it became like the place to be, and you're seeing them hanging out with all the hoi polloi, yeah, you know, like the Rolling Stones and stuff like that.
Yeah, they show, like, I think the Allman Brothers hung out there at one point, or mm-hmm, and like Keith Richards. It was quite the place.
Yep.
But yeah, as they get more and more popular, they do it more and more, like, kind of, you know, shows, and they do more and more like college lectures. And then there's one point where John and Dan were doing like a college lecture, and for some reason Belushi gets the idea to jump off the stage.
Yep.
And he ends up breaking the cartilage in his knee, because mm-hmm, jumping off the stage, that might happen.
Yes. And so he breaks his leg, and he wasn't able to be in the show that week, right?
Right. Yeah. He was the doctor prescribed him painkillers, and that kind of triggered, you know, his kind of dependence on.
Yeah, they were saying like, oh yeah, and then the doctor took him off the painkillers, but Belushi wasn't ready to be done with the painkillers yet, so he keeps on with the painkillers. I mean, it's just that addict, that addiction personality coming to the fore, you know?
Yeah. It's like, oh, my foot's asleep. Better get some painkillers.
Well, it's just, you know, it's just such a sad thing, because he was just such a stupendously talented guy, and you can't help but wonder when you're watching this thing, is like, well, you know, what could he have gone on to? What more could he have done if not for this horrible addictions that he had?
Yeah, I know. It's a bummer. It's like, damn it.
But maybe it's a thing where it's like, you know, he wouldn't have burned as bright if he didn't burn so fast or something, you know?
That might be it. I mean, a lot of people think about stuff like that, where some, like a performer who is just so kind of such a big presence and sort of, I don't know, maybe not anarchistic, but like very, you know, just
larger,
a very,
than like, life.
Larger than life, rebellious type of spirit. Like maybe, you know, Kurt Cobain or Joplin or Hendrix or anything. They all, and like they always die young. And
yeah,
it's like one of those things that better to.
I mean, Belushi, he was like 33 when he died. And you know, so, in some ways you can look at him and be like, well, he had a full life, a very full life in the time he had. But I don't know. I'm 48 now, and I look at 33. 33 seems like nothing to me now.
Yeah.
You know? That's...
I mean, 33 is super young.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he... Like you say, he accomplished a lot.
He did. I mean, it's just... It's just unavoidably sad.
It is. But, yeah, then they also talked to other people. I mean, as brightly as he shown, there were issues to him too, because they also talked to people like Ann Beats and Jane Curtin about talks about how it was difficult to work with him because he didn't seem to respect women really. I mean, like, famously he's been known for saying women aren't funny, and
him
not wanting to do sketches if they were written by women. But at the same time, he thought Gilda was funny. So
yeah, he had this tremendous affection for Gilda Radner, which,
as we all do.
Yeah. I mean, and maybe that just speaks to how great Gilda Radner was, or if Belushi was just like, oh, well, she's the exception that proves the rule. I don't know. I mean, but yeah, he did have some of that old world Albanian sexism kind of wired into him.
Women no fun. Go in kitchen, make sandwich.
That's
my Albanian impression. I don't even know if that's accurate.
No, dead on.
Nice. Yeah, but see, that's the thing. Again, this is the thing where kind of I scratch my head at, just because he has these two sides to him, where he's like very sweet and nurturing and very like a romantic, artistic side to him. But then he has, like you said, like this kind of macho alpha dude, aggro, women ain't funny side. I'm like, how?
Yeah,
it's just really strange how those two personalities exist in the same.
It's such a weird attitude to have when you're in the original cast of Saturday Night Live with people like Lorraine Newman and Jane Curtin, who are not just two of the funniest women around, two of the funniest people around. And you have like people like Ann Beats and Rosie Schuster in the writers' room, and it's like, how can you think that women aren't funny when you're surrounded by so many funny women? It's just
and I'm sure he's worked with funny women in like Second City and too. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I mean, dude, like you see that what you think is not correct. So maybe I don't know if it's what you've been told or what, but like you see it's not right. So just maybe change the way you think there, fella.
Yeah, it's just so weird.
Yeah, I don't know. Part of me thought maybe, I don't know if I should say this, but like part of me thought, like, has anybody explored the idea that he might have been bipolar? Because like there is a thing where he does have these two sides to him. Even like I said, Tom Schiller even says where he's very sweet and nurturing and like a true artist at one point. But at the same time, he's also very anarchistic and, you know, he pushes back. So I was like, I don't know. And plus also like, the reason I say the bipolar thing is because at one point, which we'll get into later, where Judy hints that his mom might have been bipolar. So
yes. Yeah. There could be something to that. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe he had some problem in his brain chemistry that was never like properly diagnosed or something. Because, you know, partly because they didn't know as much about how that stuff worked back in those days, or just nobody thought of it. But I think you do find that in a lot of addictive personalities. They have some imbalance or something that makes them susceptible to that sort of thing.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, Lauren also went on to say, like, John always had to look like he was the boss. He always had to be the alpha male, and it was a descent into hell. And I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
And like there was and Lauren talked about the one time he was, and I think I'm skipping ahead a bit again here, where Lauren was so, or Belushi was in such bad shape that his doctor didn't think that he could do the show. And like his, according to the book, like his lungs were filling with fluid. And the doctor was, and Lauren was saying, like, we've kind of built the show around Belushi. We can't really not have him in the show. He's got to perform. He can perform for like an hour and a half and then he can rest. And the doctor's like, no, you don't understand. If he performs, he might not live. And Lauren Michaels is so fed up at this point. He just goes, well, what are the odds? And the doctor says 50-50. And Lauren Michaels says, I can live with that.
Jesus Christ, Lord.
Wow. That is hardcore. He tells like kind of a longer form of this story in the book. They abbreviated it a bit in the documentary, and he's saying that at that, like, Belushi kind of like raised an eyebrow and got up, and he performed in the show, but it was not his best performance. And he says, you know, and that probably killed Belushi, just knowing that he might have put out a bad performance.
Yeah, that was, God, that goddamn one, that's cold-blooded. But, yeah.
But to be fair to Lauren, if you're dealing with an addict and an addictive personality, it wears you down and it, you know, you get to the end of your rope. So
yeah,
I think,
no, I hear that.
I think probably Lauren was there at that point. I don't think Lauren was quite as callous as that story makes him sound, to be fair, but.
No, I get it. That's true. But still, it's like, it's hard to hear. Like, and also, I think even before that, they mentioned that Belushi missed an entire episode because he was in L.A. and had an ear infection, and he couldn't get on a plane because, like, when the plane lands, it pops his ear or something like that.
Yeah, his eardrum would burst, they were saying.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to say then there was that sketch that Dan and Jane did that I thought was really funny. Where it was like an opening sketch for an episode where, like, it was like the Jane and Dan were playing themselves in the sketch, and they were in the locker room, and then Dan said, "Oh, hey, Jane, how's it going? How's Patrick?" You know, Jane's husband, and then Jane was like, "Oh yeah, he's good, he's good." And Jane says, "Hey, is Belushi still in California? I mean, What's he doing out there? Like 8 to 10 for possession?
Yeah.
And then Dan says, "Oh no, he has an ear infection. And he has an ear infection. He's really sick. It's really bad. He can't, you know, he can't get on a plane because of his ear infection." And then Jane says, "Well, I sure hope he didn't get it catching it from listening to himself sing."
Yeah, it's cold.
It's hilarious. I laugh so hard at that.
I'd never seen that clip before, and it is very funny. Yeah, and they say that when that happened, Belushi also submitted a film, and this is like when he was become like a big success in Hollywood. He like Animal House had already happened, and the joke of this was that he's like, he says he can't come to the show for health reasons, but you see him like lounging by the pool with all sorts of women in bikinis and things like that. And the implication being just, he's too big of a success to worry about SNL anymore.
Yeah. And at that point, like Lorne, I mean, he'd already been getting fed up with Belushi, but when Lorne saw that, he was like, dude, that's not cool. Like,
yeah,
we signed you to do the show. You need to do the show. You can't just be la-dee dying off in La La Land just because you're this big old star. But
yeah, I think Lorne just didn't like that it made it the whole thing into a big joke. And he was like, you know, oh, the whole thing was just basically like blowing Belushi for a few minutes. And he was like, yeah, no, we're not going to air this. And they never did. I think this documentary is the first time that's come to light.
Yeah, so you can see some unseen footage, folks, in this thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
all right, but, well, we touched on Animal House. Go back to that. So, I think, where are we at? Oh, so there's one point where, you know, John Belushi is getting, you know, bigger and bigger success. He goes out to L.A. You know, the relationship between John and Judy gets a little fractured, and he becomes more distant to her, so they split up for a while. But then, you know, of course, Belushi misses her. It seems like Belushi's a little codependent, too. He seems like he really needs somebody around him a lot in order to...
Yeah, I mean, they refer to Judy a few times in the documentary as his anchor. Not in the sense that she was dragging him down, but that she was like a stabilizing force in his life. And that she helped him kind of like spinning off into the deep end. And it seems like he really did need that sort of thing. And it seems like Judy was the big stabilizing force in his life, but Aykroyd tried to be that as much as he could, and they got a little later they got a fellow named Smokey, who was kind of who watched after Belushi and just basically made sure he kept off drugs and that he didn't have strangers coming up onto the street and giving him drugs, which would happen.
Wow, imagine being that big, just be like, hey, I've seen you from TV. Would you like some cocaine?
Yeah, and that's literally what it was like, because everyone had this affection for John Belushi, and I guess everybody wanted the cachet of like, hey, I got high with John Belushi, or I gave John Belushi some drugs. Yeah, they would just walk up to him and like, you know, hand him pot or cocaine or whatever.
And, wow.
And I mean, so it really was a full-time job keeping the man clean.
Yeah. I mean, I got somebody to buy me a beer after a show, and I thought I'd made it, but
right.
I'm not at that cocaine level. That's next level shit.
That is some next level shit. I understand the cocaine. It's rather expensive.
Yeah, that China White, it don't come cheap.
No.
All right, so like I said, Belushi was missing Judy. They kind of got back together. They reconciled. Mm-hmm. They went to Aspen for vacation, and they got married.
Mm-hmm.
Right there and then.
Yeah.
It's a little, yeah, it's, you know, it's been years in the making, so they tied the knot. And while this is happening, we see Doug Kenny and Harold Ramis starting to write Animal House. Of course, they wrote the part of Bluto specifically for Belushi.
Yeah, because they said every Animal House needs a great animal. And they all just looked at each other at once and said, Belushi. And so, a thing they all instantly agreed on. And I think it was John Landis was talking about this. He was talking about like they took out a lot of Belushi's dialogue in Animal House and just let him do stuff non-verbally. Like there's that classic scene where Bluto's trying to cheer up Flounder after he's wrecked his brother's car. And, you know, he's just like, Belushi's just smashing a beer bottle over his head or crushing a beer can against his forehead and just like, and he does it just without a word. And they say, like, that's very close to, what the real John Belushi was like, because he was just trying to make you laugh and make you be happy. And they described the character Bluto as being a cross between Harpo Marx and the Cookie Monster. And they were both like kind of destructive forces, but they didn't, neither one meant any harm. So it was just, and that was kind of the key to Bluto.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's there were a lot of, I mean, you can go back and listen to our Animal House episode and, you know, we get more in depth there, but yeah, you'll definitely, it's really interesting to see like how just a look at the camera, just him like breaking the fourth wall, looking to the camera, just him raising an eyebrow, just him doing, you know, just nonverbal cues. That's enough to like crack you up and endear you.
Yeah.
To him.
I mean, it just shows how talented Belushi was and how likable he was. You just instantly responded to him and you liked him and you got in his corner. And even though like the character Bluto is doing all these horrible things, I mean, they kill a horse.
Yeah, they do that.
Yet you're still on Bluto's side.
That horse lived a good long life.
That's too bad that horse died and got Bluto into trouble.
For that dumb horse, Bluto wouldn't have got away with it. He would have got away with it.
You know, and he's like getting a ladder and spying on all the sorority girls, and you're still just like, oh, that Belushi, he's such a scamp.
oh, get out of here, Belushi. I'll chop up this dead horse for you. Get it out of here. You rascal.
And that's probably how he got away with such excesses in his real life. I mean, just because he was such a likable personality. I mean, I think a lot of acts can also be very charming, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, he's been charming since day one. And when people want to be around him, people gravitate towards him, and people, when they were around him, they didn't want the party to stop. So that's probably why they just like, hey, do some coke. Let's get this party started. Let's do some blow, do some more drugs, do some alcohol. And like, they were putting all these things into this person, just wanting a good time, not thinking what that would do to the person.
Right. And they also talked about how Belushi would kind of, he had different circles of friends. He would live his life in 8-hour shifts. Like, so you would get to the end of 8 hours with Belushi and you'd be like, okay, well, that's enough for me. I'm out. And then he would just go on to the next group of people and go 8 hours with them. And it's just frightening to think of, you know?
It's really, really exhausting. Like I probably could have kept up with that in my younger days, but I hear that now and I'm like, dude, I need a nap. Just hearing all of this.
I need a nap after I record this podcast.
I'm winded.
Well, it's 4 p.m. I should take a nap.
Dude, you got to stretch before every podcast. I keep telling you that.
I know. I'm endangering my life by doing this, but
I do it for you people. But yeah, and then they also talked to other people who knew him. One of his friends, Layla Nabulsi, talks about how she remembers one conversation she had with Belushi saying, like, I don't know how you do what you do. You're just so comfortable up on stage. You just go up there. You have no fear and just do, you know, you just do whatever. I don't know how you do that. And John said back to him, well, I don't know how you do what you do, which is like you're comfortable in life.
Yeah.
Like, how do you do that?
Yeah.
Which is very telling.
I totally get that. I totally get that. I've had people like ask me like, oh, are you nervous when you go up like and do stand up? And I'm like, no, I feel more awkward like having the unscripted conversations with people before and after the show.
Yeah. It's more common than you think, folks.
Yeah. Yeah. Animal House with Belushi, it really catapulted him to another level of fame because that was such a monster hit. And he never really had another hit quite like it. But at one point he was on the number one TV show, Saturday Night Live. He was in the number one movie, Animal House, and he had the number one album with the Blues Brothers. And so he was like the king of all media before Howard Stern was.
Right, it's probably,
you know? He was a genuine king of all media, you know?
Right. All right. Well, so let's get into Blues Brothers. So it seems like he kind of got into being the Blues Brothers because, according to the doc, he was like the film with the Animal House was being filmed in Eugene, Oregon, and like an interviewer asked him, well, what'd you do in your off time? And he said, oh yeah, you know, I sang at this hotel, this Eugene hotel. I would just sing blues. It's like a hobby. Mm-hmm. And from that, he was like, oh, I really like doing this and I'm pretty good at it. So maybe I'll get, you know, my buddy Danny and we'll be like the Blues Brothers. And it just,
well, yeah, like Aykroyd was the guy who like turned him on to the blues. Like Aykroyd was already like a blues aficionado and he turned Belushi onto it because he was like, oh, you're from Chicago and you don't really know the blues. And then after that, like Belushi became obsessed with the blues and he would like make his own mixtapes and things like that and just subject all his visitors to that. And yeah. And it's, that obsessive personality or that addictive personality, he just had to know everything and do everything.
Yeah. See, I thought it was Aykroyd that hipped him to the blues, but they didn't really mention that. It just made it sound like he was always into the blues. But
yeah, they kind of glossed over that a little bit. But yeah, it was definitely Aykroyd who got him into it.
Right. So they decided to become the Blues Brothers, and I think they said it was kind of a joke at first, and but like Judy helped them sort of create the characters a little bit and helped them with the costumes and the band, mm-hmm. and like before they knew it was kind of becoming a legit thing, and then they were doing it on SNL to warm up the crowds, and it became a thing, and then. Sure enough, they were able to get a record deal off it, and that record became a huge hit, like we said.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, they're performing as the Blues Brothers. They're doing live shows, and it was something else. It's just amazing. And then, you know, eventually they do, after they leave SNL, they do the Blues Brothers show. The Blues Brothers movie, I mean. And Aykroyd tells a very amusing story about like one day on set they couldn't find where Belushi was, and then, you know, somebody on the crew was like, oh, I think I saw him going across the street to that, and Aykroyd just like knocks on the door of somebody's house and they're like, oh, you're here about Belushi, and Belushi just knocks on the door of this perfect stranger's house. And he's like, hey, you know who I am. I'm tired. And he comes in, he makes a sandwich with stuff out of the refrigerator, has a glass of milk, and then he just falls asleep on their couch.
That is the ballsiest of ballsy moves.
Yeah.
That is a boss move right there. And I think Aykroyd nicknamed him America's Guest at that point, where
yes.
America just being cool enough to do that.
Yes. There's a great story. Carrie Fisher doesn't tell it in the movie, but she tells it in the book, where she says that, like, Belushi got into his head that Dan Aykroyd and I should be together and they should be a couple. So, like, he invites Danny over and he invites me over and then he passes out on the couch. He says, this was the John Belushi version of a blind date.
Hey, Dan, this is Carrie. Hey, Carrie, this is Dan. Well, hey. Oh, yeah, just sleeping on the couch like Homer Simpson.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, things were looking up for Mr. Belushi. Like, he was this huge star. He was able to buy his parents a ranch in mm-hmm. California. And like we said, he wasn't super close to his parents, but he still loved them.
Yeah.
I think at one point Judy says, oh yeah, well, his parents' names are Adam and Agnes.
Yeah.
And Judy says, well, you know, Adam, his dad was, you know, he was happy, but he was like also a very depressed man, very solemn man. And mm-hmm. that's where he said Agnes was kind of up and down and she might have been bipolar. That's what made me think, whoa, oh, is Belushi bipolar as well?
Yeah, I mean, and you can certainly inherit that sort of stuff from your parents. So, yeah, right. Very possible.
Yeah, but like the fact that John wanted to make his parents happy and he's hoping his success would like kind of heal the family and bring them closer together didn't really happen. It didn't really work the way he wanted to, and he got kind of mm-hmm. bummed out by that.
Yeah, yeah. And, right. You know, I mean, honestly, that kind of reminded me a little of the thing we saw in the Doug Kenny movie, Futile and Stupid Gesture, where yeah. Doug Kenny buys his parents a new house with all his success in the comedy world, and it still doesn't really repair the rift between him and his parents.
Yeah, it's just like, what do you people want? You got a house. You got a nice driveway. God's sakes. Turn that front upside down, you son of a so-and-so.
Yeah.
All right, so, I mean, at this point, Belushi and Aykroyd have left SNL because now they're, like, pretty much, you know, kind of bigger than the show at this point.
Yeah, they kind of are. The doc kind of glosses over 1941, doesn't it?
Oh, very much so.
I think the most they get into it is, like, after Belushi does 1941, he's like, after he signs for the Spielberg movie, he's like, I never have to worry about money ever again. But they don't really talk about what an infamous disaster that movie was.
No, yeah, they... I mean, I still haven't seen that movie, just because I heard it's...
I've seen it. We should definitely cover it at some point. That would be an interesting one to cover.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, is it like interestingly terrible, or is it just terrible, or what are your thoughts on it? Just a brief synopsis.
It is, okay, first of all, I haven't seen it in years. I haven't seen it in at least a decade, if not more. It is a bad movie. It is bad in an interesting way. There's a lot of excess to it. It's very over the top. I mean, you know, one, I think Spielberg's not really a comedy director. So it's more about the spectacle and stuff like that. And, the movie's got problems. Let me just say that.
All right. All right. I'm intrigued, good sir.
Yeah.
So Aykroyd and Belushi, they become bigger stars. Of course, the Blues Brothers were the hit. You know, you can listen mm-hmm. to our episode about that as well.
Yeah. You know,
dig in the archives. And of course, since he's becoming a bigger and bigger star, that of course means more and more access to drugs, cocaine. Aykroyd was like, oh, he definitely has a problem with coke. Judy says things like, yeah, we were talking about getting into rehab, but John didn't like that idea.
They also talked about how, like, it would be more of a problem on night shoots on the movies, because, like, apparently... In this era, you would just take cocaine to get through the night, to stay up all night. And
a fresh cup of coffee, like I said.
Yeah, it's just, it's so nuts to think.
Yeah, it's just like, are we out of coffee? Do we have no more soda? Well, yeah, how about a bag of blow?
Yeah, it's nuts.
Oh, man. So, we see him kind of spiraling a little bit with the drugs. That's where Smokey, like we were alluding to earlier, that's where Smokey comes into play. He was a man who used to be Nixon's bodyguard, mm-hmm. I think they said. And he was... they had him on to keep drugs away from Belushi.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And he did a good job with it at the time that he was with them. They talk about how... They got a place in Martha's Vineyard, and they had what sounds like a pretty idyllic summer there. And Belushi was like clean the whole summer, and it really seems like he turned a corner.
Yeah, he was doing well. He was like, I think they said he was clean for like almost a year. Mm-hmm. And I believe the interviewer Tanner said that to Carrie Fisher, saying like, oh yeah, he was mostly clean for over a year. And Carrie was like, well, that must have been a screaming hell for him.
Yeah.
Because, you know, she knows that they're addicts. They're both addicts. And then that's when she said that line about how it's not the drugs are the problem, it's the sobriety.
Yeah.
That's the problem, which I thought was interesting. So at this point, we see Belushi kind of wanted to do different things. Because I think at this point, he didn't know what his audience wanted from him or were expecting from him. And I think he wanted to escape his kind of goofy, slapsticky persona.
I mean, he talked about this. They show a clip of him in an interview with Gene Shalit on the Today Show. And he's like, you know, if I just did what the audience wanted, I would just do Bluto over and over. I'd do like Animal House Goes to the Space Shuttle. And he could just do that same sort of thing over and over. And he wanted to be an actor and do different types of parts. And
So like his first foray into that, this movie called Continental Divide, which I've never heard of until this documentary.
Oh, really?
But I don't think I ever heard of it.
It was a movie he did with Blair Brown, and he played played like sort of, I think, a fictionalized version of a real journalist, Mike Royko. And yeah, it's I've seen bits of it on TV. It's an interesting movie, and it's him playing kind of a straight role.
Okay. Yeah.
So yeah, it's very interesting in that regard, and it really makes you wonder, like, what he could have done as an actor if he'd gone on in that direction further, you know?
Yeah, like, I think it was, I mean, they say he lost 40 pounds for the role, and he was really trying to be a more serious actor, but, I mean, from what I understand, like, the movie didn't do that great, and people didn't know exactly how to take it, type of thing. But, you know,
Bruce McGill from Animal House, he talks about this. I just found the relevant quote in the book, and he says, John always introduced me like, this is my friend Bruce. He's a great actor. After a while, I said, John, why do you make that distinction? You're an actor. I'm an actor. What's the deal? And he said, oh, no, I'm just a sketch player. He always felt early on anyway that he did something different. I always felt he was so talented that what he did came so naturally and without any apparent effort on his part that he kept thinking somebody was going to find out he wasn't really doing anything. That's not an unusual state of mind for really talented people. I think that's one of the things that drove John and frustrated him so. And in the book, they followed up with a quote from Harold Ramis. He says, it's called the imposter syndrome, and everybody has it.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Wow. Yeah, it's weird. Like he was this performer who everybody loved and everybody thought was amazing. But, like, yes, I mean, you know, as performers, I sometimes I'll have it from time to time, you know.
Yeah.
And but you think, like, it'll be something that you'll be able to shake after a number of years, after you get some, like, notoriety and some accolades.
Yeah.
But, I mean, apparently it's just something that never goes away. Jesus.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is kind of like that thing. You're always chasing that high, or you're chasing that next thing, and you think, like, oh, if I can get to this level, then all my problems will be fixed and I'll be happy. And you never really quite get there, because with each new thing, there are new complications, and yeah.
That's a bummer. So after Continental Divide came out, it didn't seem to do very well. I think that's when, like, Belushi started to slip deeper and deeper into drugs and depression and whatnot. At one point, I think somebody mentioned he got rid of all his blues albums, and he was getting more into punk rock, like Fear and the Dead Kennedys. They show some footage of him playing the drums at CBGB's for this band called Dead Boys.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting. Like, he was really more into, like, the angry, anarchistic, you know, music. And I
know that they ended up booking the punk band Fear on Saturday Night Live, which, you know, became an infamous music booking, just because Belushi was such a fan of the band. And I think he even introduced them on the show. And this was after he'd left the show.
Yeah, I think from what I remember, like, he left the show, but that's when SNL was, like, in the doldrums, or it wasn't what it was, and they were, like, starving to have Belushi back on. So he was like, all right, I'll come back on for a little bit, but only if you book this band Fear. And they were like, fine. And, like, I don't think he was in any of the sketches. He was literally in, like, the cold open for, like, a minute, but I don't think he even has any lines. And then they have Fear on, and I mean, guys, if you don't know about the infamous Fear episode of SNL, the Halloween episode, look into it. It is bananas. Their performance was something else.
Yeah.
It was some kind of something.
Yeah.
It was like if you watch it, you're like, oh my God, this is pure uncut chaos. This is just like, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
A lot of fun. A lot of fun for you and the whole family. Bring the kids. All right. So we see Belushi in the, you know, really not doing well mentally. And that kind of all comes to a head at the filming of his next movie, Neighbors, which is a pretty infamous shoot. Like, have you ever seen this movie, Neighbors? I've never seen Neighbors.
I've never seen it. I know of it. I've read stories of it. Basically, like, Neighbors, it was a movie. It was based on this black comic novel. I don't have the author's name handy, so but they decided to adapt it into a movie. But it's about, like, you know, one neighbor, one sort of nutty anarchist neighbor who drives his uptight neighbor crazy. And you hear that, and you're thinking, like, oh, you're making a movie with Belushi and Aykroyd. So, of course, Belushi's going to play the nutty neighbor. But Aykroyd and Belushi decided, no, we're going to switch roles, and Belushi's going to play the uptight one, and Aykroyd's going to play the nutty one. And they at the time thought this was a great idea. And I know the screenwriter Larry Gelbart, the great Larry Gelbart from MASH, and Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. He was like, no, this is a stupid, insane idea, and you should not do it.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the that was one of the problems. Another problem was the director, because the director where they used was the guy who directed Rocky and just won an John award for Rocky.
Yeah,
he just won an award for Rocky, the Oscar, and like they were having big problems with him. They were saying, this dude doesn't know comedy. He's ruining the movie. They were trying to get him off the movie. I think at one point, like they talked, there was an interview in the documentary with Harold Ramis where Harold Ramis got a call from Belushi saying, "Hey, I got the screenplay I want you to look at," and he's like, "All right, I'll look at it when I can." And
I'd like you to direct it, and Ramis is like, "Oh yeah, I'll look at it when I can," and he's like, "No, you have to look at it now," and then Ramis was like, "Wait, isn't this Neighbors? This is the movie you're shooting. Doesn't that have a director?"
He's like, "Whatever." Whatever, man. You want the job or not?
But
yeah. So like the production, it was fraught with just a lot of infighting, people not knowing what the vision of the movie should be. They wanted it to be like more of a dark comedy. It became like sort of more surreal and trippy. I think at some parts, like even Aykroyd was like rewriting it as they were filming it, and like.
Yeah.
That caused like the screenplay writers were like really that really pissed them off. It was a tough shoot. Now, of course, at the time that during this, Belushi was getting more and more into drugs. He was like seeping deeper and deeper. I think at some point they said like you couldn't see it, but while they were shooting, there were some parts where people were like propping him up and holding him up while they were shooting his scenes. Like he was like really spiraling, and Smokey wasn't there, and it was just. It was not good. Like, I think Belushi knew as he was filming it, oh, this movie isn't what this isn't going to be what I wanted it to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And they also, had that problem with the night shoots. Like I was talking about before, apparently they had 1 week of night shoots on this. And that's when Belushi was really in bad shape, and he was doing drugs. He relapsed to kind of get through the night shoots, and he was really erratic and, yeah, not it was bad news, man.
Right. So it's not a good shoot. The movie comes out, and the whole thing just like the movie bombed, basically. Like,
yeah, the reviews were pretty brutal, and nobody liked it at all. I mean, it was just a just almost a comedy of errors.
Yeah, like one reviewer said it was a vapid waste of celluloid.
Yes.
Which is not good. But actually, I did notice, like, I think Roger Ebert liked it. I think he said it was, like, an interesting psychedelic comedy. So that's a plus.
Okay.
So you got that. Thank you, Roger. But yeah, this was a... this isn't what Belushi wanted. It just really bummed him out.
Yeah, yeah. And, then the doc, of course... unavoidably has to cover his death as well. It talks about he was working on another script with Don Novello, who was a writer for SNL, and you probably know him as Father Guido Sarducci. And they were writing a screenplay called Noble Rot, which I don't think ever came to be in any fashion. And Aykroyd was also writing the script that would end up becoming Ghostbusters at the time.
Yeah. For those that don't know, like when Aykroyd was writing Ghostbusters, he had the three original Ghostbusters he had in mind was going to be him, Belushi, and Eddie Murphy. And he was writing this at the time. And while Belushi was really going through it, and I think they say one of the reasons Belushi was really in a deep funk over this was because they did an interview with one of his friends, Mitch Glazer. And Mitch said, well, John's choices were always what the people wanted. Like, he was able to tap into, the people's sensibilities, the public, what they thought was good and funny. And so when he came out with two movies that didn't hit with the public, that really fucked with him. He was like, oh, wait, do I not know what people want anymore? Do I not know what they want from me? Or, and like, it really kind of fucked with his head.
Yeah. Yeah. He was out west, and he was by himself, out in LA, like, because, Judy talks about this. She was going into therapy at the time, and her therapist was like, you should maybe consider yourself first for a while and not, you know, live your entire life for John. And so she decided not to go out west with him. And so he was feeling kind of alone and bereft without her there with him. And that might have played into his death somewhat. On Judy at all, but...
Yeah, I mean, you never know what's going to be ultimately, you know, we're all responsible for our own lives. So, it definitely, I mean, it didn't help, but like, it wasn't the thing that pushed him over. I mean, they also talk about how John actually met up with some of his old, old friends from the old days, his old band. They got back together.
It was a high school band. Yeah.
Yeah. They played for the rap party for Taxi, the TV show Taxi, with his old band. Yeah. And like, he was kind of in despair. He was kind of reaching out to people. He was kind of, you know, trying to dig into the past to maybe hope that nostalgia would like kind of help him through all this, but it didn't quite work out. Then they interviewed Dom Novello, who wrote the Noble Rot screenplay with him. And like, I think they said Belushi said, Novella said that Belushi handed the screenplay to the studio and they didn't like it, but they said they'll make it if Belushi was in the movie The Joy of Sex.
Right. And they wanted him to be in a diaper.
That was their big
concept.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
And like, Novella was, of course, incensed. He's like, dude, it's like, this Belushi is like a big deal, and you're gonna have him like in a diaper, like this fucking industry. They don't care about you, like.
Well, that's such an easy, hacky kind of idea. Like, oh, put the fat guy in a diaper, you know?
Yeah, and it's just. I think at this point he maybe. I feel like the older Belushi or the younger Belushi rather would have like fought them more tooth and nail, but I think at this point he's at such a low he didn't have the fight in him, which is I don't know. It was a bummer. I think, and then they talk about how Aykroyd, the last time he talked to him over the phone, he was trying to console him, and he was writing Ghostbusters, like he said, and he said, he was like, you know, you just gotta get through this, you gotta get out of LA, you gotta be in a good place, Aykroyd was also saying, oh, I gotta finish the script, and I gotta go right out to him, and he was, I think you can hear that it still bothers him that he didn't get out there in time.
Yeah, I mean, he says something like, yeah, I've got to live with that, or I've got to carry that. It really is something that he is carrying for the rest of his life. Because, right. I mean, they were tight.
Yeah, no, they were best buds. They were like, they're brothers, basically.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, the unfortunate, inevitable end to all this, he ends up dead over a cocaine and heroin overdose at the age of 33 in an LA hotel alone, which was
he wasn't alone. That's actually something watching this film, you would think he was alone, but there was somebody named Kathy Smith who was there, who was actually she was convicted of involuntary manslaughter because she was gave him that drug cocktail. Doc doesn't include anything about her at all. So yeah, watching this, you would think he was alone at the time.
Yeah. This ain't Wired, apparently.
No. Yeah.
This is much better.
Most things are. I mean, go back and listen to our episode about Wired. If you haven't heard it before, that movie is insane. It's been well over a year since we watched that movie, probably going on 2 years now. And I still can't get over how nutty that movie is.
Yeah. What was that?
Yeah. You were like, enough about what Belushi was taking. What drugs were the makers of this movie taking?
Yeah, what the hell? Yeah, folks, if you... I mean, I don't want to even recommend Wired, but you kind of have to see it just to see how insane it is. But it is...
I mean, it's like I said earlier, it's a failure. It's a failure in a really interesting way, I think. It's not a boring movie. It's just a what the fuck were they thinking movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, listen to our episode about it if you haven't seen the movie or you can't track it down. I think we will give you the gist of it, and your mouths will be agape at the decisions they made going into that movie.
Yeah, it's an interesting failure.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, and you know, then they of course talk about the funeral at Martha's Vineyard they had for Belushi, and yeah, it kind of ends at that. I mean, like the last words are. They talked to Aykroyd saying how, like, no one can learn what Belushi did and no one ever will. Like, he was, like, he was one in a million.
Yeah.
And, of course, and then, of course, they ended with Belushi doing, you know, with a little help from my friend and his, you know, spot-on Joe Cocker impression.
Yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, that's Belushi, guys. Really, really good documentary. Hour and 48 minutes, so it's a little on the long side, but you get a lot of information in it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really well done. I think it's really worth seeing. If you don't have Showtime, you can get like a free week to just sample it. That's what I did. I went on through my Amazon Prime account, and I was able to do that. And I'm really glad I did. I'm glad I checked this out.
Yeah, yeah, it's really, you definitely get like a better sense. I mean, like I think I was saying throughout the thing, like I kind of wish they would explore like why he was two sides like that, why he was this introspective, gentle artist and also this big aggro bully. When I brought up the idea, I brought up that we were doing this podcast to my sister, you know, longtime listener, hey, Mel. She said, oh, why are you doing an episode about Belushi? Like, he's overrated. He, you know, Aykroyd and Bill Murray were funnier. He was like a misogynist and blah, blah, blah. And he was some of that, you know, if not all of that, but he was also had this other side to him too. So, I mean, I wonder if people think about that too. Like, people don't like him because they thought he was just, you know, this angry blowhard. But maybe, I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I don't know if they think that or not. I didn't know that your sister felt that way, but, yeah, no, I think he's totally deserving of the hype, personally. I think
he was a
talented guy. I think it's sad that his life ended the way it did. I would have liked to have seen what he would have become if he had lived longer. But, you know, that just wasn't in the cards for him, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where somebody just, you know, shines so bright and just comes out of the gate just like... Just like, you know, like a bat out of hell. It's hard to, it's hard to imagine what they would be. Maybe they would have like calmed down a little bit more, and maybe been a bit more subdued, and maybe to become more of a serious actor or what. It's really, it's really hard to say what he would have become. But I mean, I enjoy his work. I mean, he definitely had a presence. Like once you saw him on the screen, you couldn't take your eyes off him. Like, you were always wondering.
Yeah.
Oh, what's he going to say now? Like, there was, like, I think I said this about, like, SNL in the past. Is the show is always best when there's a little element of danger in it. Like,
And Belushi embodied that, really.
Yeah. I mean, he was, like, the first element of danger, you know, and then, you know, of course,
you never entirely knew what he was going to do.
Like, he was that element of danger. And, of course, you know, people like Farley and, you know, maybe. You know, Will Ferrell or Chris Kattan, whoever, they kind of carried that on throughout the years. But it's one of those things where that element of danger, that doesn't really, you can't really have that as you get older. So you have to sort of maybe mature into something else and it morphs into something different. But yeah, like, I guess, you know, I mean, we'll never know what it'll be, what it would have been.
Yeah.
He was a pleasure to watch while he was here.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was Belushi.
Yeah, yeah. We highly recommend you guys watch it. Check it out. If you're an SNL fan, you'll get a big dose of SNL nostalgia from this, and it's
yeah,
I really dug it.
Me too. Yeah, I learned some stuff. It was good, and I also highly recommend the book Belushi. It's by Judith Belushi Paisano and Tanner Colby. So check that out. I'm sure you can still find it on Amazon or a used bookstore near you.
Right. Exactly. So yeah, that's the episode. And guys, thanks for listening once again. As always, if you want to follow us on the Twitter, you can follow us at SNL Nerds Show. Tweet at us. Let us know you love us. Let us know how we're doing. You know, reviews. We could always use a good review. Nice little 5-star review on the
in a long time. So yeah,
it's been a minute. So guys, get on it. I mean, what are you doing with your lives? And yeah.
Our individual accounts, I'm at Trumbull Comic, TRUMBULL, and the word comic. And Darren?
And as I'm at Darren Credible, DARIN Credible, Twitter and Instagram.
Yeah, okay. And we will be back next week with SNL's return with Jason Bateman and Morgan Wallen.
Wallen.
Is that how we say it? Wallen.
Yep. Wallen. Wallen.
That seems so wrong to me, but okay. It's his name, Wallen.
I believe it's pronounced Morgan Chang. you like that?
That is us for next week. Darren, do you have anything else before we sign off?
Nah.
Okay. All right, that is us. That is it for us. We will see you next week with Jason Bateman and Morgan Wallen. But until then, nerds out.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.